Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. I normally don't share much about my personal health unless it helps the discussion along, but it seems appropriate here. Since my grandmother died very young of metastasized colon cancer, all of my immediate family do colonoscopies regularly. At 48, I decided to do a baseline, even though I had no symptoms, just for peace of mind. Because of my work, I knew about the possible brain-damaging effects of the drug combo used during the procedure, and I looked for a gastroenterologist who agreed to forego the medications. I was shocked at the difficulty of the so-called prep that's required the day before, and more shocked when I arrived at the hospital and I saw the hose, yes, the hose that's used for the procedure. Suffice to say that since then I have investigated alternatives. My feelings about screening for cancer has changed as well. Additionally, people seldom consider what they're prepared to do if something is found and the practitioner wants to operate immediately. Today we're covering a new technology for testing for cancer without invasion, a blood test that's not specific to cancer type but reveals its presence and the extent of its development. Our guest is physician and biochemist Samuel Bogosch. His name is spelled B-O-G-O-C-H. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeffrey Fawcett, Ph.D.
Thank you, Lena. According to a large survey released last month, most Europeans believe that cell phones and cell phone antennas damage their health. About 3 of every 4 people interviewed expressed moderate to extreme concern. They also expressed considerable concern that they were not being adequately informed about these risks. Again, about 3 out of 4 people interviewed. 2 out of 3 Europeans felt this way about the health effects of Wi-Fi, wireless computer technologies. Because a recent expose in England found that Wi-Fi networks in schools exposed children to much more radiation than cell antennas, several British school districts are reconsidering their commitment to Wi-Fi. Quite the opposite is the case in San Francisco. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors is considering a citywide Wi-Fi network that would make internet access free to citizens. The board will soon decide whether the Wi-Fi network proposed for the city should be reviewed for its environmental and health impacts. Originally, the plan was given a pass on conducting an environmental review by the Planning Commission. An appeal filed by the San Francisco Antenna Free Union caused the Planning Commission to kick the issue up to the Board of Supervisors. Wi-Fi boosters don't want such a review. They don't think there's anything to worry about. Mayor Gavin Newsom is a big fan of free Wi-Fi. Nathan Ballard, speaking on behalf of the mayor's office, is quoted as saying that the union's appeal, quote, is a frivolous maneuver designed to delay free Wi-Fi for no good reason, end quote. Mr. Ballard is not well informed. Many well-meaning supporters, including journalists, are in the dark on this issue. In fact, vast numbers of Wi-Fi supporters strenuously ignore the public health implications of a citywide Wi-Fi network, which is why an environmental review is desirable. What's maddening is that there's a less risky alternative under consideration, a wired fiber optic network owned and operated by the city that would also provide free access to the internet to San Francisco's. The Board of Supervisors has adopted the precautionary principle as city policy. Performing an environmental review would mean evaluating how to safely deliver free internet access to the citizens of San Francisco, comparing the possible environmental and health risks of a wireless to a wired network. The lead character in the science fiction novel The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by the late Douglas Adams is admonished to always carry a towel. The reason, he is told, is that he might encounter the ravenous bug bladder beast, the most vicious creature in the universe. However, it's also the most stupid creature in the universe. It believes that if you can't see it, it can't see you. So, when you encounter a ravenous bug bladder beast, you throw a towel over your head so you won't see the beast, so the beast thinks it can't see you, and so it slinks away. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors is about to throw a towel over its head. Unfortunately, unlike the ravenous bug bladder beast, the microwaves from a wireless network won't slink away. But enthusiasm abounds. It will bring the internet to the poor. It will be free. In fact, the city will make some money on it because the current deal has the Earthlink Google consortium that will install and run the network paying the city for the privilege. And the citizens of San Francisco, especially its children, will become a public health experiment. Free Wi-Fi isn't likely to be free. But I'm sure Wi-Fi boosters will have their towels ready. A transcript of this editorial is available at the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is editor of the Progressive Health Observer. There's more information about him on our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org. And now to our topic at hand, which is cancer screening, and my guest, Dr. Samuel Bogosh, B-O-G-O-C-H, who is an MD and also has a PhD in biochemistry from Harvard, founder of the Neurochemistry Laboratory at Harvard Medical School in the late 50s to early 60s, taught at Harvard and later at Boston University School of Medicine until 1991. While working at Harvard, Dr. Bogosh was the first to describe the structure of brain brain gangliosides. Since the late 50s, Dr. Bogosh has characterized the structure and function of brain glycoconjugates, investigated cell-cell recognition, training, and memory, and studied the nature of malignant transformation in brain cells, as well as the cancer process and other tissue types. The cumulative body of scientific work by Dr. Bogosh and his colleagues led ultimately to the discovery of the tumor marker malignin, a peptide or protein fragment present on the surface of cancer cells. Malignin appears to represent a general transformation antigen produced in cancers of lung, colon, prostate, and breast, as well as most of the other forms of cancer. The discovery of malignin by Dr. Bogosh led shortly thereafter to identification of the presence of specific anti-malignant antibodies within the blood sera of both normal and cancer-afflicted individuals. It is the determination of the relative level of these antibodies within the blood serum, and that's what we're going to be discussing, which is the AMAS test, that permits most cancer patients to be distinguished from the vast majority of most clinically free cancer-free individuals. So welcome to you, Dr. Samuel Bogosh.
Thank you very much.
The first thought I had is that when you developed this test, were you consciously looking for a less invasive way to test patients at risk?
Not really. No, we were following the basic question of if an antigen or a glycoprotein appears in cancer that is of unusual structure, does the body recognize it as foreign? That is, does it make immunological adaptation to it, creating antibodies and maybe having cell responses? So we were asking the question, if when we found this unusual protein, which had lost some of its sugar in the glycoprotein, we asked whether this was unusual enough that the body would say this is a foreign protein and make antibodies to it.
So to sort of follow on to that question and in a way of explaining the AMAS test, why don't you tell us the steps you used in its development, because you just started to do that.
Well, as soon as we got the unusual structure of the malignant peptide, which was a small piece of a large glycoprotein that was obviously disturbed, we developed a test which allowed you to combine malignin on a fixed framework with a blood serum sample and to bind any anti-malignant antibody that was in that blood serum. And so the specificity was established over a course of many studies so that most antibodies do not bind to malignant. Only anti-malignant antibody does. And it does with a very high degree of specificity. In fact, it's almost like a monoclonal antibody in humans. We then asked whether this antibody was increased in cancer. In other words, is this part of a defense mechanism in the body? And the answer was positive. Yes, it is increased in cancer. And as we studied it, we found that it was increased earlier in cancer than most of the other tumor markers. As you know, most of the tumor markers measure the antigen, that is the protein that's released into the bloodstream from the cancer. They haven't been studying the antibody. And the protein is released into the bloodstream in measurable amounts later than the antibody response, or the antibody response precedes, can be measured earlier than the antigen response. The antigen is what's measured in common other cancer tests like CEA, CA125, etc. These all measure the antigen that's released from the tumor, the PSA, from the prostate, etc. That antigen can be measured usually not as early. For instance, in CA125, in ovarian cancer, in the first stage, when the cancer is still contained within the ovary, the antigen for that cancer is not released in large enough amounts to measure in 95%. That is, only 5% can you use that test to pick up the very first early stage of cancer of the ovary. By the second stage, when the cancer is already broken out of the ovary and is in the peritoneal cavity, the percent accuracy of the test goes up to about 40 or 50%. And in the late stages, it gets to be 80, 85% accurate. So the test is most useful late, unfortunately, when you need it less, not very useful early. The antibody test that we're measuring, AMAS, is just the opposite. Yeah. It's very useful early, much earlier than the antigen tests work, but it's knocked out late when the antigen tests get to be best.
Just to sort of simplify, I suppose one could say that the antigen is the material, or in some cases the irritant to the immune system, and the antibody is the response.
Correct.
Okay, so this test works better for very early detection, and in fact, it appears to work for detection earlier than anything else, including, you know, sort of early detection with a mammogram, for instance.
Oh, yes, mammogram detects when you have masses that are substantially larger, so that it can be used in conjunction. For instance, if you're worried about a very tiny speck and a mammogram, the test may be useful to define whether that's a malignancy or not.
Now, Jeff and I are not fans of early detection for some cancers, and when you and I talked, you agreed that for some cancers, this really early detection sort of subjects people to very invasive sort of treatments too early on.
It might. There's the good and the bad news there. The good news is if you can pick up a very early cancer and treat it without too much trouble, that can be very good. I mean, President Reagan, for example, had three or more cancers detected and treated surgically, and he lived to a ripe old age to enjoy Alzheimer's disease. But, the question is whether you want to pick up the early cancer, and if you can, it can be very, very useful. However, in some cases where early cancers don't really act up very much, they don't, they're there, but they're dormant. Dormant is the usual term applied to them. They're not dividing rapidly. Rapid replication of the cancer cell is what makes the trouble. So that if you have cancer of the prostate defined, there have been studies in people who, for instance, died of car accidents where the prostate was examined. They had no symptoms, no evidence of any trouble. And they found cancer of the prostate in quite a substantial number of these. However, none of these had reached clinical symptoms. And now it's becoming apparent that a large number of the cancers of the prostate that we detect in adults, and even where there are some symptoms, are dormant and don't do much. And the problem is, how do you differentiate the ones that are active, rapidly replicating, from the ones that are dormant and not going to give you much trouble? Because 90% plus of the cancers, actual cancers that are found pathologically in the prostate, do not cause death. You die of something else. Do you want to undergo surgical treatment for those or not? And there are different opinions on this, and of course it's a complex issue. Are you part of a high cancer family? Are the risks higher in your case than others, etc.? But the definition early is very difficult of what treatment is appropriate.
Well, and also it varies enormously depending on which, as you just pointed out, which cancer we're talking about. You
exactly.
know, like with lung cancer or probably an ovarian cancer, which nobody has been able to catch early before, this would be really an important thing to be able to do.
Yes, we're concentrating on that. We've just started a large-scale study of that and of ovarian itself. To see, we know that in small studies we've picked it up earlier than all the others, and let's see if it goes for larger ones.
So I think I'm understanding that the test, the AMAS test, will tell you the extent of the body's response and the extent of the proliferation of the cancer. Am I right?
Yes, it can. If you have a test which is normal and you have no symptoms, and you're otherwise well, then that can be reassuring. If you have advanced cancer, and you have an advanced cancer can mean any cancer larger than, say, a centimeter, or with smaller than a centimeter, but with metastases elsewhere, you'll have a negative or normal AMAS test very often because the antibody is wiped out. That's what I referred to earlier. When the earliest stages of cancer, the antibody is the best. Late stages of cancer, the antibody is not as useful. If, however, you're coasting with a high antibody level, a defined cancer, and your antibody drops markedly without treatment, that's a signal that things are not going well, and those are usually associated with early death. So it can be used to monitor, but usually people will have a treatment of cancer, and when the treatment occurs, we just have a large paper that's going to be coming out in some over 300 cases. We have the recurrence of cancer in a cured cancer, which is a normal AMAS level, and when the cancer recurs, the antibody goes up again. So you have a chance to catch it early on first occurrence and on recurrence, but it's more difficult if you have an existing known cancer. But then you don't want to do the test necessarily for known cancer anyway.
Well, in fact, if you have a cancer that is large and beginning to metastasize, generally speaking, people have symptoms by that point.
Yes.
So
yes.
You wouldn't.
No,
it wouldn't.
Point in doing the test for those.
It wouldn't sort of sneak up on you so much.
No.
I just want to ID the show. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm on the phone with Samuel Bogosh, B-O-G-O-C-H-M-D, Ph.D. He is the developer of the AMAS test at Onco Labs. Their website is the requisite W's, and it's Onco, O-N-C-O-L-A-B-I-N-C, OncoLabInc.com. Be sure to add the Inc, or you will get a very annoying other website that's not theirs. onco.labinc.com. We're talking about cancer screening. So part of what's so interesting about this test is that it seems to indicate that the immune system has a way of dealing with cancer. And what we're observing, and what you proved with this discovery, is that the immune system does that. So what have you learned about the immune system from this?
Well, since, well, for many decades, we've had bits of evidence that the immune system is involved as a defense against cancer, although frequently there have been reactions because we didn't have enough evidence. And, for instance, in 1975, there was a big conference which declared the immune system was largely irrelevant to cancer study. Well, we've gotten cured of that. We now have some products that help from the immune system, and we know a little more about it. For example, we studied the concentration of anti-malignant antibody in healthy, normal people, over 3,000 of them, as controls for our cancer studies. And we studied it, the concentration in relationship to age. Now, if you're a 20, 30, 40-year-old, you have a low malignant antibody, which begins to rise. There is a maturation of the AMAS, of the anti-malignant antibody level, so that it approaches but does not go into cancer levels. It's, say, 80, 90, 100 micrograms per ml, cancer level being 135 or greater. Now, if you are from a high-risk cancer family, that is, people who've had a lot of cancer in the family, when you're 20 years old, we learn to make as much anti-malignant antibody as a 60-year-old makes from a low cancer incidence family, which indicates that the struggle begins early, and it also has its S-shaped curve of increase, which is like the normal, but it starts higher and it ends higher. Frequently it ends in the cancer range. So this is a very positive, clear-cut relationship of antibody level to the concept of immunosurveillance. And we haven't had that before. To my knowledge, this is the first evidence we have of an antibody, quantitative amount of an antibody, which relates to age in the normal healthy person and relates to cancer when they get cancer. So it makes the evidence, I think, pretty clear that this antibody is one of a number of things that are involved in defense, immunodefense against cancer throughout our lives.
As I spoke with you yesterday, I mentioned to you that one of the concerns I had about traditional screenings is that it often uses a lot of radiation, which is also cancer-promoting. I would think that along with the benefits of being able to ease up on having people bombarded with radiation to check for certain cancers, the other benefit is that you reduce the number of biopsies that are necessary if you use this test. Am I right?
Well, this is all possible. We don't like to say either or because I think we're still at the beginning of early detection in cancer. And we have to really assign which methods are useful at what time period and for what kind of cases. There's some cases that you, for instance, if you get a positive anti-malignant antibody, you've got to start looking for what's causing that. And you may be using a lot of the other methods to do that, including radiation methods. So I don't think it makes sense to say, it's a little like if you're in a war, if you get a new fighter plane, you don't throw away all the bombers you had and all the tanks and celebrate the new fighter plane. All of them have their function, and we have to figure out where they're most useful.
You've had this test sort of available for about 20 years, is that right?
Yes.
And I'm understanding that you have done a fair amount of study of how it's working, as you just mentioned, you've tested to see what the normal levels of anti-malignant antibody is in somebody who is cancer-free, for instance, so
right.
That you're not, yeah. Why has this test not sort of caught on? Why is it that you guys are sort of the only people doing it?
Well, the first, there are several reasons for it. Maybe some we don't know, but the ones we do know, first of all, it was widely thought that the immune system was not that important in cancer detection. As a matter of fact, only about 2 years ago, there was an editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine which celebrated the notion that it might be useful to begin to look, instead of looking for the detection of cancer cells, look for the immune system's response to those cancer cells. This was a new idea 2 years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine. And so when we started this a couple of decades ago, people thought we were off the wall. It was totally irrelevant to be studying cancer, let alone to be studying an antibody. Everybody knew antibodies had nothing much to do with cancer. So that's reason number one. And it's that thinking has changed as the evidence has come in that, yes, the immune system is relevant, and yes, antibodies are relevant. And some antibodies are even therapeutic, let alone useful for detection. So that's a big change. A second change is that the test works quite well in the described setting, and most of the other tests have not worked that well. For instance, if you have a 70% false positive rate with PSA, you don't find it easy to think about a test that has a 90% or better accuracy early in cancer. It doesn't make sense. It's too good to be true, quote-unquote. So that's held up things. That's a second reason that's held it up. And I think those are the two major ones that have really made it slow. But now it's very heartening to see it's changed as people begin to recognize the importance of immune system and the importance of early detection, both of them. I mean, American Cancer Society has been trying to sell early detection for decades, hasn't gotten very far, and is just beginning to be thought about as useful now.
One of the things that makes me nervous about early detection is it changes the cancer statistics. It sort of makes it look as though people are being cured of cancer or having survival rates from cancer, when really what's happening is they've just been diagnosed earlier.
Just picking them up early, but it doesn't influence mortality. There's a huge debate going on with that. You may have seen some evidence of that in terms of the new methods for detecting smaller masses in the lung by X-ray. And some studies, counter studies across the street from both excellent institutions saying this is no good. You're just picking it up earlier. And that's a debate that is going to go on for a while. I think intuitively, most scientists and most people think, if it's there and we can get it early, I'd like to get it out, please, you know, or I'd like to treat it successfully. And the statistics we'll look at as we go along. So I think that's sort of the position that a lot of practitioners are at the moment. But it is an active, disputed area.
What did you mean when you said that some antibodies are useful? Which antibodies are useful?
Well, there's an antibody that's useful now in treatment of breast cancer. The antibody Rituxan is an antibody treatment. And there's two or three other antibodies are being tested that look, and that one's on the market. And it helps about 20% of breast cancer cases, but that 20% it helps well. And there are a bunch of other antibodies now in trials that are promising.
So the idea here would be to mobilize the immune system to deal with the cancer on its own.
Well, they're not mobilizing. They're synthesizing, making the antibody and administering it.
Huh. I see what you're saying.
As a treatment. It's unfortunately rather expensive, but that's a separate issue.
It's all rather expensive. And the only thing that's not expensive is your test.
Yeah, it's not very expensive, $165.
That's included with all the shipping and all that?
Well, the shipping is on top of that, unfortunately.
Okay.
But if you're Medicare, you don't pay anything, and we are Medicare approved.
Good. That's good to know. So you had mentioned that the antibodies go up as we age.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering whether you have you done any thinking at all about what we might be able to do to maintain good levels. I mean, do you ever see people have their antibodies not go up?
Well, we're gathering a lot of evidence now. We've got over 50,000 individual tests done in the past several years, and we're trying to gather it and sift through it, and there's a hint in that. It's not a completed study, but there's a hint that people do have an influence on this. And what's particularly interesting to me, although not proven, is that some people who have their own favorite ways of helping their health by 2 dozen or 100 different ways have said, oh dear, I have a rising antibody level, I'm going to treat it with this or that and the other, and then they come back with the next test that show that they've dropped their antibody level. Now, that's Very hard to understand, but it's possible that we are able to influence those levels by proper health measures.
Mm-hmm. We're going to need to take a very brief musical break. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with Dr. Samuel Bogosh, B-O-G-O-C-H, M.D., Ph.D., from Oncolabs. His website is onco.labinc.com. We're going to take a brief musical break, and if you would stay with us, we'll be right back with more discussions of cancer screening. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. I just want to remind you that there is information about our guests, the Progressive Health Observer, and a free stream of this week's show, and lots more at Your Own Health at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number is 707-874-2772, and our guest today is Dr. Samuel Bogosh, B-O-G-O-C-H, M.D., Ph.D. We're discussing cancer screening, and his website is onco.labinc.com if you want more information. One thing that I've been thinking about in regards to your test, Dr. Bogosh, is I'm wondering if it is also useful to use the anti-malignant antibody test when you've found cancer and you're doing a watchful waiting. Can it be used that way, or is it become too blunted by the antibody going down if it's a fairly aggressive cancer?
That have been found useful. One is when you're taking a treatment, whatever it is, surgical or pharmacological or whatever, the antibody drops with successful treatment of the cancer quite clearly, goes back into the normal range. And that's very reassuring to see. And then you can follow it up with three-monthly, six-monthly tests to make sure it stays down, the antibody level stays down. And as a matter of fact, there's a talk given by a physician which at first was embarrassing to me because I was in the audience, I heard it, and I thought it was a bit exuberant. But he told about a patient with kidney cancer that had been picked up with the AMAS test, and then it was treated by surgery, it was removed, and then the antibody dropped to normal, and the antibody was then tested every 6 months or so for a number of years. And the physician said it was incredibly reassuring to both the patient and the doctor to see this go on. And he was getting more and more excited describing this. And finally he said, and I know because the patient is me, which is rather impressive. But we have quite large studies now, and one of them to be published, I think it's on our website now, on breast cancer, showing that if the antibody stays down, it's a very good sign, and recurrence is picked up with the same accuracy as first occurrence. So it's a new ball game after a successful treatment of cancer, and you want to look for recurrence. One way to look for it is with the anti-malignant antibody.
Well, and in fact, there are a variety of cancer treatments that are not conventional but are still scientific. You know, like I discussed with you the work of Stanislav Brzezinski, who in fact has found a way to sort of turn on and turn off different genetic variants to get a response against cancer in the immune system to get it to sort of work by itself. And he's under clinical trials all the time, but his results are just staggering. They're amazing, and people don't get sick from the treatment. But even so, even if someone wanted to experiment with a treatment that was unconventional, certainly it seems to me that they could take a month or two instead of having everybody jump down their throats trying to push them into the sort of cut and burn stuff to see how something's progressing.
Well, we haven't gotten into the treatment side much. We're pretty much concentrated on the detection side. But no matter what the treatment is people receive, whether conventional or unconventional, if the cancer is down and out, if at least temporarily, the antibody is similarly in the normal range, so it's useful.
So you can track it.
You can track it, exactly.
I'm wondering if, with the number of people that you've now tested over the last 20 years, whether you see any trends in terms of environmental impact in different geographic areas where there might be more immune insults that are carcinogenic.
We haven't done any studies in that regard. There are some intense studies, for instance, the Long Island studies, families that have BRCA1 high-risk states and also have contamination and trying to sort out the difference between your genetic high risk and what the environment is doing to you.
Yeah.
And those are very complex studies, but we don't have much to add to it yet. We're getting involved in the BRCA1 study now. There's a study going to start at Stanford, which will be looking at high risk people exclusively in regard to the AMAS test to see whether it's useful to sort out which ones are getting trouble, which ones are not.
Yeah, and in addition, I think both Dr. Fawcett and I agree that the problem with genetic testing is, and this is consistent with Brzezinski's findings, is that it isn't it's a blueprint, but it isn't necessarily the outcome, because different genetic variants turn things on and turn things off. So it's the environmental exposures are actually very provocative in whether or not something that you have a genetic propensity for actually presents.
Absolutely. The two are important. I think you used the comparison of looking at the blueprints for constructing a house and then what happens after that, the kind of builder you have, etc., the environmental influence on the blueprint. And so with the genes as the blueprint and the environment as the influence, you have a complex system that hasn't been sorted out too well yet.
I wanted to, without giving out my numbers, I have my AMAS test results in my hand, and I'd like to understand better how to read this test. You have the AMA, it's UGML, I don't remember.
Micrograms per milliliter.
So you have the ranges.
Quite a bit of it in the blood.
Yes.
Normals have under 100 micrograms, but they may have 70, 80 micrograms. When we're born, we have about 40 micrograms, 40, 50, and as I said, we gradually mature up into the 80, 90, 100, 110 range. But if we're at risk, we go up above the 110 in the borderline range, and if we have cancer, it's 135 and over, and that's at a level of 90% or better. So that's the way that's measured. Now there are
let me ask you something specific. Under the first column where it says AMA, and then it has the readings, it starts with
S tag.
Well, no, even before the S tag, you have a bunch of numbers. You have 700, then you have 500 to...
The ranges. Yeah.
Why are there so many different ranges? Is this because you're looking at whether or not somebody actually has cancer or not?
Yes. Okay. The ranges there are just numbers that go from 0 to 700, 800 or higher.
Okay.
And so when you get a number, you'd like to look at the range and see where you are in that range.
Right. And then you have the different columns, S-tag, F-tag,
right.
and NET-tag.
There are two antibodies actually involved in the test, two variants of the anti-malignant antibody, one which binds quickly. It's all bound to malignant in 10 minutes. And the other one, the other variant of the antibody, takes 2 hours to bind totally. So there's a fast binding, F for fast, and a slow binding, S for slow. The importance here is that we've, in the laboratory, when you try to make anti-malignant antibody, and we've done this and published it, if you stimulate B cells, these are the immune cells, with malignant, in the test tube, you will get the production of anti-malignant antibody. We've shown this and isolated it. And in the first few days in the test tube, you'll get the fast variant, which appears. And then after that, you get the slow variant. So they not only are they separable individually, they're separable monoclonal antibodies, too. But they're separable in the test tube when you try to make them. So there are really two versions of the antibody. We don't know why this is, but very frequently, antibodies have more than one variant, and two of them are needed to kill cells. We've shown that anti-malignant antibody kills cancer cells at very low concentrations, at picograms rather than micrograms or nanograms. So it's an extremely active killer of cancer cells, and it's floating around in all of us. So we assume it's there to knock out cells that are up to no good.
So in other words, the S tag and the F tag are showing you how much activity there is
of
in the immune system of each.
Of each of those two.
Mm-hmm. But is it the NET tag that is the one that you're really concerned with?
What you do is, because the test involves running 5 minutes for binding and then 2 hours, the 2 hours for binding includes the 5 minutes. So to get your true value, you have to separate them. You have to subtract the fast value of binding, the 5 minute binding from the 2 hour binding, and that gives you your net. It's the net tag which correlates most closely with the clinical. You can do it by just doing S tag, but you lose a couple of percentage points of accuracy.
But in this case, and I am very close to 60 and I do have a family risk, my S tag and F tag numbers are, one is very close to, well, I don't want to go through a whole thing, but they're reasonably high numbers. They're not under 100. But my net tag.
They can be in the 200 and 300 range.
Yes.
The net that counts.
And what does that mean?
What it means is that if your slow tag is 400 micrograms or higher, you have a 90% chance of having cancer. If it's below 400 micrograms, you don't. And similarly, if your fast tag is 175 or higher, you're at risk. So we look at both of those, but we look at the net, most importantly.
And the net should be below 100.
The net should be below 135.
Yeah, well, mine's in a nice range, and you told me I was the test results are normal.
Right.
So. And I have to say that did give me some peace of mind. It really did. Because of my family history.
It's good to have it. Remember, this is objective, totally objective, and it is based on quite a lot of evidence now, and it's not foolproof if we, you know, nothing is, unfortunately, in biology, but it's 90% or better, and it's reassuring. And it's one piece of evidence. It shouldn't be the only thing that you do, and most people understand that intuitively. As well as scientifically, you don't rely on one thing alone, as we said before.
Yeah, although I'm not anxious to do another colonoscopy, especially without symptoms.
That's again the clinical judgment sphere, which we don't get into.
I know you don't.
But if you've got a good oncology person or a good GP, general practitioner, they're going to add up the pluses and cons here and say, well, I think you need this test or that test. Give you an interesting example. A close friend of our family, a young woman, had a lump removed from her breast, which had some malignant cells in it. And then she popped and nothing more happened. Things were fine. They thought everything was good. A few years later, she developed a little lump over her right clavicle. And the doctor said, that's, for some reason, he said, that doesn't look very impressive. You know, it's a cyst or something. And she had an AMAS test, and it was elevated. And she said, I really would prefer it. I think this should be biopsied, taken out and biopsied. Okay. Here's an example where the AMAS test promoted surgery, right?
Yes, I understand.
So he said, oh, all right, if you want me to. And he took it out, and it was a cancer, all right.
Mm-hmm.
But it was cancer of the thyroid gland, mm-hmm. which is very interesting because you would not have thought. She had no symptoms of which she was aware of this damn thing, and it would not have been picked up unless a biopsy was done, and the biopsy wouldn't have been done if the AMAS test hadn't have been positive.
Right.
Well, she's fine now. The thyroid often spreads around locally, but it doesn't make a big deal elsewhere if it's caught early. And that's an example of where sort of multiple things happen. It's useful to pick up cancer. It's useful to lead to a biopsy, which tells you for sure you got it. And obviously to treatment.
I just wanted to let people know you're listening to an interview with Samuel Bogosh, Bogoch. He is the developer of the AMAS test, and you can read more about it at oncolabinc.com. You have a pretty good reputation among the doctors I've talked to of not having sort of false negatives or false positives. Do you have anything? Is that your impression from?
Well, it's true, and it's very lucky. The luck is that the antibody is almost monoclonal, very pure, and it's not like most other antibodies. It's highly specific. So when it goes up, and you can measure it with its antigen, you've got a test which is 90% or better, positive or negative, and not so compared to PSA, for example, which has 70% false positives. Can you imagine that? I mean, 70% of the time you get a positive with a PSA, you don't have cancer of the prostate. So it's very difficult. Now, of course, we're learning that if you have a rising value of PSA, that's better. You learn more. And if you do rising an AMAS test and you have rising AMAS and rising PSA, then you've really got some evidence that may justify going forward with surgery or whatever. But that's the kind of struggle that we're in now, trying to get the best evidence from one or more indicators.
Do we have somebody vacuuming your room there at the hotel?
No, they're outside.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And is that loud?
Well, we can hear it. I don't know if your door's open.
I think they are vacuuming the leaves or something.
They're air blowing the air.
Something,
things,
right.
Okay. That's very pleasant. No, it's okay.
I'll close it. Hold on.
Okay. One thing I want to ask him when he comes back is since we're...
That may help.
Oh, that was very fast. Yeah, that did help. When you test somebody that has antibody response going on anyway, like somebody with an autoimmune problem, will that affect the S-tag and F-tag results?
No, we've done a lot of controlled groups with a variety of autoimmune disease. And as I said, it's a very specific antibody. The other antibodies don't interfere.
Well, that's useful.
Very, very useful. You don't get the interference.
One of the things that your son mentioned when the three of us were talking on the phone yesterday is that one of the problems with getting the AMAS test is that it's a simple blood draw, but it has to be done properly, and you send a kit with very specific instructions, and then the samples have to be treated correctly according to the instructions, and they have to be mailed overnight with dry ice, and that makes it a little more arduous to get this done.
Well, it's terribly arduous. We apologize for that. In fact, we thought it's so arduous, nobody's going to do it. It's kind of a tribute to the fact the test is helpful, that it is done as much as it is. And the good news is we're working on an automated test we hope to have out maybe in a year, which avoids that. So you can get a pinprick and get it done locally.
Oh, how wonderful.
Not have to ship. But that's still a wish. It's not yet a reality.
So this would be onto some blotter paper or something?
Yeah.
Oh, that would be great. And now your phone's ringing.
I'll turn that off.
I know that we have to let you go soon, especially because your daughter, I guess, is about to give birth.
Yeah, she's going to have her first.
Yeah, that's very exciting. So you and your wife have been working together, and now your son is also on board. It's sort of a family operation. Has the response to the test and the kind of results in the work, has this exceeded your expectations?
Oh, yes, very much so. As I said, we thought originally the thing is so cumbersome that people won't bother with it, but it has exceeded it. By the way, it isn't just the finickiness, although they teach you to be finicky with quantitative biochemistry, but the fact is that the antibody loves, for example, just as an example, loves silicone. It'll bind. So if you've got silicone in the tubes, it will bind to it, and you lose a third to a half of the antibody when you come to measure it. So we have to have it done in tubes that are not. Excuse me a sec.
Hello?
I assume that he's answering the phone because there's probably going to be news about his his daughter who is...
Sorry.
That's fine.
Yeah.
The silicone tubes.
Huh?
You were talking about silicone tubes.
So we have to send out a tube that's free of silicone.
Yeah.
And you have to use that tube. And what happens, unfortunately, sometimes people say, oh, I don't know what they're fussing about. We use silicone all the time. Well, you may for other antibodies, but not for this one.
Yes.
This one binds clearly. When, matter of fact, if we have a minute, I'll tell you. Somebody says,
yes.
Well, you should be able to tell... from the silicone that we use in people where we're doing breast surgery, we'll send you the silicone, and if it's if it binds antibody, you should be able to extract it. So we did extract it, and indeed, that's an even more complicated test for cancer. If you want to send us the silicone, we'll extract it and tell you whether it's got a lot of antibody or not in it.
You're talking about breast implants?
Yeah, that's a joke, but it works. And the reason it works is because the antibody binds silicone. And that's why we can't have silicone in the tubes. That's why we send out tubes that are free of silicone.
One of the other funny things you mentioned when we were talking is we were talking about the antibodies and how they're the body's native way of destroying cancer cells. And you had a funny story about, you know, the joke was how many antibodies does it take to kill cancer cells?
Yeah, well, it normally the range of antibodies that are active against in killing cancer cells is in the microgram or nanogram range, as each is a thousandth smaller. But we're in the picogram range with anti-malignant antibody, which I think is the most active anti cancer antibody described to date, at least, and so it's quite an active agent, and its specificity is what allows us all to carry it around. That is, it doesn't bother normal cells.
But you had this sort of it came out like that joke. How many people does it take? How many such and such? So you said you actually someone posited how many antibodies does it take to kill a cancer cells? And it turns out it takes two.
Oh, yes, it takes two, both the S tag and the F tag.
And you explain.
And the reason for that is, you know, if you look at the original studies, Caesar Milstein studies on monoclonal antibodies, they were quite frustrated. They were studying them for their ability to rupture red cells. And as they purified the antibody more and more, it was unable to rupture the cells anymore. So then they found that if they threw together the antibodies they'd purified, they were able to rupture the cells again. And the idea that you need more than one antibody to kill was born then. It was about in the 60s and 70s. But we have that same situation. We have an S tag and an F tag. And the story I told you was about a friend who had no knowledge biologically, but he said, well, that's easy to understand. You need one to hold them and one to kill them. And that sounded bizarre and a little bit like a TV story until they doing X-ray diffraction studies and electron microscopy found that one antibody, in fact, freezes the membrane. The second antibody pokes a hole in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it's done in nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be nice if more cancer treatments actually mimicked nature. I mean, I realize that you said at the beginning of this that that's kind of moving in that direction with this discovery.
Well, we hope we'll get some therapeutic products out of it, too, and we're working on that, but we don't have much to say yet.
Did you have a really hard time with the FDA when you first posited
No, people say, how did you get FDA approval? And we just said we did what they told us to.
No, you were lucky you could.
Well, yes, in fact, we're lucky we could. They're, you know, it's a very complicated situation. They're often scientifically very sound. And if you're willing to go through the things that they demand, it works out. But it can take time.
Lots of time and lots of money.
Yeah. Too. Well, yeah. In our case, it wasn't so much money as time. But we did all the things to satisfy them the test works the way we said it did.
So along with the test that will be easier and less cumbersome to collect and send, what else do you have on the future?
What have you done for us lately?
What are you planning to do
for us lately? We have this wonderful cartoon of the cavemen sitting around the fire, which you may be familiar with, and they're talking about another caveman who's got a long beard, and he's leaning up against the cave wall, ignoring them. And they're talking about him, and they say, all right, so he invented fire, but what has he done since?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think the antibody is fire, but we're trying to do something better. And what we're trying to do is two things. One is to automate it so it isn't such a nuisance to ship. And the second thing we're trying to do is to use the information for treatment purposes.
Yes.
And have a vaccine. In fact, we've isolated the key amino acids in malignant that are involved in setting up the immune system. And there are just 16 of them, 16 amino acids tied together, make this what's called an epitope, or the antigen that the immune system responds to. So we figured if we can make that, turn that into a vaccine, maybe we'll get the immune system generating more antibody beforehand as a preventive measure, and that would be great, of course, to have a vaccine.
Yeah, if you could deliver it without a bunch of toxic preservatives in it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is totally synthetic peptide, and they don't usually cause much trouble.
Oh, good.
So that's what we're aiming for. That's our next goal.
Okay. Well, if people want more information from Dr. Bogosh, B-O-G-O-C-H, MD, PhD, you can go to his website. It's onclabinc.com. And I wish you all the best. I hope this birth for your daughter is easy and that you have a splendid grandchild on board sometime today or tonight.
Tonight, tomorrow is the estimate.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for spending the time, and thanks for inventing a test that makes it easier to track if you have a family history instead of having a garden hose rammed up.
Thank you for a very good interview.
You're very welcome. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about your own health and fitness, our guests, the Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to Big Box Medicine, and a free stream of this week's show and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number is 707-874-2772. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.